This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Heidi Adams-Fitzpatrick, and here's what's coming up.
We found people who are in a situation of fear of another attack, and traumatized because there are people who had already fled other attacks from the armed groups.
That's Olivier Guillaume-Beer, UNHCR representative in Cameroon, on displaced people in a village attacked by Boko Haram fighters last weekend. Also, Africa nears 1 million COVID-19 cases. A U.S. statement strongly opposes foreign military involvement in Libya. And South Africa breaks its silence on Zimbabwe's crackdown, but not very loudly. Those stories and more are next on Africa News Tonight. In our top story tonight, the African continent is fast approaching 1 million confirmed cases of coronavirus, with South Africa alone accounting for more than 500,000 cases. World Health Organization officials say they're sending a team of experts to South Africa in coming weeks, as the health minister there warns the nation could see a second wave. Meanwhile, other African nations are looking at creative ways to respond to the pandemic. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
5 months after the first case of coronavirus was recorded in Africa, the continent's known caseload remains a small share, just 5% of the global burden. But, says Dr. Matsidiso Moeti, WHO Regional Director for Africa, officials are concerned about the continent's hotspot, South Africa, and the rest of the continent as it approaches a grim milestone.
The realization is dawning strongly that we will have to live with this virus for some time. There are now almost 1 million reported cases of COVID-19 in Africa, so we have not yet reached that milestone, and over 21,000 people have sadly lost their lives. South Africa remains the worst affected country on the continent and is now the fifth most affected country globally. In partnership with the Department of Health in South Africa, WHO is deploying more than 40 regional experts to provide support at the national and provincial levels in the country.
But she said experts worry the true burden could be higher than they know because of a lack of testing kits and other barriers.
I'm often asked whether they reflect the true picture of the epidemic or not. One of the constant and concerning challenges in many African countries is a shortage of kits to test people for COVID-19. At the same time, some countries have increased their testing per capita while maintaining a low positivity rate, countries such as Mauritius, Rwanda, Cabo Verde, and Botswana. Through the UN supply portal, we are supporting countries to replenish test kits and other commodities.
South African Health Minister Dr. William Kize said the nation's strict 9-week lockdown has helped slow the spread of the virus, but that unless the country keeps up its guard, he fears a second wave may be imminent.
It is possible that instead of these lines going down, when we start opening up the movement of provinces and opening more sectors of the economy and people move more easily, the sporting and all the others, then this whole surge can come back again at a much higher level than what we're seeing here.
In Rwanda, Health Minister Dr. Daniel Gamije says officials are looking at novel ways of handling treatment with a national preparedness plan that so far has cost $73 million. The tiny landlocked country has reported 2,104 cases so far. Although Rwanda is small, he said, officials quickly realized they needed to study how to manage the virus within the home and at the district level.
We came to realize that at the beginning, our response was driven by the central government, at the central level from the Minister of Health. And it appears that we could not sustain that kind of interventions initiated from the central level. That's why we decided to decentralize COVID-19 response.
Globally, the Americas have the highest number of cases with over 9 million. Of those, 4.6 million are in the United States. More than 18 million cases have been reported worldwide. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Mauritanian President Mohamed Ould Ghazouani appointed veteran public administrator Mohamed Ould Bilal as prime minister today, hours after the previous government resigned amid an investigation into alleged high-level corruption. Nicolas Pinon reports from Paris.
This announcement came in a statement from the presidency following the resignation of Bilal's predecessor, Ismaël Doul Cheikh Sidya, and his entire government. The political system in Mauritania has been rocked this year by a parliamentary investigation into alleged corruption in the government of former President Mohamed Ould Abdelaziz, who stepped down last year after a decade in power. His close ally, Ghazouani, won the election to succeed him. But Abdelaziz quickly found his government's action, including deals involving offshore oil projects, under scrutiny by parliament. The investigators on Wednesday gave a report documenting their findings to the public prosecutor. Several current ministers were questioned about suspected graft that occurred on their watch while serving in senior position in Abdelaziz's government. In brief remarks to reporters, Sheikh Sidya said he submitted the government's resignation to Ghazouani but gave no explanation. Hours later, the presidency announced the appointment of Bilal, who has served as head of the National Water Agency, a presidential aide and a cabinet minister. Nicolas Pinault for VOA News, Paris.
A statement on Libya from U.S. National Security Advisor Robert C. O'Brien calls for a demilitarized solution for Sirte and Al-Jufra and respect for the UN embargo. The statement strongly opposes foreign military involvement, including the use of mercenaries and private military contractors by all sides. It also objects to ongoing efforts by foreign powers to exploit the conflict by establishing an enduring military presence or exerting control over resources that belong to the Libyan people. VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shanawi discussed the statement with Mufta Al-Tayar, former Libyan ambassador to Mexico.
Generally, any decision from the United Nations to resolve the conflict in Libya should be welcomed and should be endorsed and should be encouraged. And that's exactly what the United States is doing right now. So in order for us to reach this stage of the conflict, it's very important. The last thing in this matter is the arrival of a German frigate to help control the leaking and the violations of the embargo. So it's exactly what we are looking for, a demilitarized zone and also a non-military activity that could affect any solution reached by all parties.
The statement strongly opposed foreign military involvement, including the use of mercenaries and private military contractors by all sides. And the statement also objected ongoing efforts of foreign powers to exploit the Libyan conflict by establishing an enduring military presence or exerting control over resources that belong to the Libyan people. What do you make of that?
Let us, first of all, establish the fact that all those who are intervening directly or indirectly in the Libyan matter, they have certain goals to achieve and certain agenda. There's no doubt about it. For example, if you look at the Russians are looking for Libya as a geographical, political position, also not only in Libya, but also on the south of the Mediterranean. And this could replace her with some of the losses it suffers in other locations. Also, Russia and others, of course, are looking at the oil and the Libyan gas. This is one example of the foreign entities that intervene in our matter. The other one is, of course, the Turks. Turkey would like to establish military bases and would like to have huge investment in Libya. The move that's been taken by the United States, which I consider is a swift and strong move, would like to see the Russian expansion in Libya contained, and also would like to see other interventions going along with the line of peace and negotiation in Libya.
The White House said that President Trump has spoken with several world leaders about Libya, and as an active but neutral actor, the United States is pursuing a 360-degree diplomatic engagement with Libyan and external stakeholders across the conflict to find a solution that supports Libyan sovereignty and protects the shared interests of the United States and partners. How crucial is a U.S. active role to push for a negotiated political solution in Libya?
Let me begin by saying that the United States have a strong relationships with different parties that are involved in the Libyan conflict. Maybe also inside Libya, they also try to outreach every part in the conflict, and that's good. So by saying this, definitely the United States can play an active role, positive role, and would be welcomed from all parties. The United States have the economic, military, and political means to play a role, to invest it in this matter in order to finish the struggle in Libya, and also to push for a political solution and to push for a dialogue. So definitely, the United States can play and will play a positive and active role in this conflict.
And that was Mufta Al-Tayer, former Libyan ambassador to Mexico, speaking there with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shanawi. The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, says poor roads and the threat of further Boko Haram attacks is preventing it from helping civilians in a camp for displaced people in northern Cameroon. The UNHCR says hundreds of displaced people and aid workers are trapped in the camp, which militants attacked over the weekend, killing 17. As Moki Edwin Kinzaker reports from Yaoundé, the UN is calling on Cameroon's military to help.
Olivier Guillaume Biye, UNHCR representative in Cameroon, says he remains concerned by the situation in Gaochewe, a village attacked by Boko Haram fighters last weekend. He says he was part of an emergency UN mission to assess the situation and evaluate the protection and health needs of those affected. He spoke on Wednesday in Yaoundé after visiting the northern village on the border with Nigeria.
We found people were in a situation of fear of another attack, and traumatized because there are people who had already fled other attacks from the armed groups. We are advocating for the security to be reinforced. We could not provide assistance as we are doing in other sites because of the threat of violence, but also because the roads are poor, inexistent, rendering any movement very difficult.
Beer said some of the displaced people were insisting on leaving the Ngauchewe village camp, and some had left. He quoted some of them as saying that it was not the first time they were attacked by Boko Haram on Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria. He said they need urgent psychosocial care and humanitarian assistance. On Tuesday, Cameroon officials, escorted by the military, brought food and humanitarian aid from President Paul Biya. The village and surrounding areas have suffered neglect because of Boko Haram terrorism. Schools, hospitals, and some markets have been abandoned and access roads have become dilapidated. Mijiyawa Bakari, governor of Cameroon's far north region, says it is not easy to channel international humanitarian assistance to Ngauchewe and surrounding border villages. Bakari says more troops have been deployed to protect civilians and humanitarian groups. He says the fighters will have very difficult moments in the days ahead as more troops from the multinational joint task forces of the Lake Chad Basin have been deployed to secure the border. He says militias have been equipped with motorcycles and communications facilities to quickly inform the military of any suspected movement. He says the government is aware fighters have infiltrated the villages. The camp, attacked by Boko Haram on Sunday night, houses 800 displaced people. After the attack, the UN reported that more than 1,500 villagers and displaced people had escaped to the nearby town of Mozogo and surrounding bush for safety. The villagers said Boko Haram fighters had infiltrated communities. Nurse Marie-Giselle Ngeshe leads a group of seven humanitarian workers from the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Cameroon. She says Boko Haram threats have stopped them from going to Gaochewe to assist the sick and wounded. She spoke via a messaging app from the northern town of Mozogo. She says the number of wounded people from the weekend's attack in Gaochewe gives her an idea of Boko Haram cruelty. She says her group was ready to go and replace their colleagues in Gaochewe, but were told by local militia groups that Boko Haram had infiltrated the area. She says the militias warned them against going to the village and said their peers cannot leave the village either. The UN reports that Boko Haram violence in the Lake Chad Basin region has cost the lives of 30,000 people and displaced more than 3 million others. The UN also says Boko Haram remains a threat, and the decreasing humanitarian assistance from donor agencies makes it look like a forgotten emergency. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
The South African government has stopped so-called emergency processes that allowed it to bypass normal tender procedures for purchasing personal protective equipment, or PPE, to combat COVID-19. The action comes after allegations of corruption were leveled against several companies linked to high-ranking members of the ruling African National Congress, or ANC, which were contracted to supply PPE. Darren Taylor reports.
The Corruption Watch NGO says the graft has cost South Africa hundreds of millions and perhaps billions of rands, and worse, perhaps even resulted in deaths. Some firms were supposedly paid for PPE they never delivered in a country with the world's fifth highest COVID-19 infection rate and a death toll of 9,300 people.
There's a couple of people, myself included, warned the Treasury as far back as May that this was inevitable and that they should take proactive action to stop it. Sadly, Treasury is now taking reactive action, but better late than never.
Jordan Hill Lewis handles finance matters for the chief opposition party, the Democratic Alliance, or DA. At a parliamentary meeting last night, Finance Minister Tito Mboweni said the government would now follow an open tender process for the supply of COVID-related goods and services that would prevent corruption.
It'll certainly be a huge stumbling block in the way of the rapacious hyenas, I think is the words that he used. It won't stop it, because even the open tender processes we know all over government are still abused, but it is much more difficult to abuse it.
Mboweni says he wants all State Departments to publish publicly all details of COVID contracts, the companies they're given to, and their directors. Hill Lewis urges him to deliver on this.
He is empowered to issue a Treasury instruction to that effect, but hasn't done so yet. And I pushed him in the meeting to please give a specific date when he would do so. We haven't got that yet. We'll certainly keep pushing. And I think that transparency will also make a big difference, because then everyone can see exactly who these companies are that are getting at each contract.
He's concerned that this isn't happening because powerful and corrupt elements within the ruling party are pressuring the finance minister. Mboweni's spokesperson denies this. The DA and many in civil society say the COVID contracts shouldn't be awarded to ANC-connected firms in the first place.
There is this lack of accountability in the governing party that makes it very unlikely that they will disclose these things.
Hill Lewis says it's very unfortunate that the ANC can't be trusted to legitimately bypass normal and lengthy tender processes during what is a real emergency. It can't be trusted, he comments, because it has so often in the past created false emergencies.
I've seen examples where rubbish collection trucks break down and local governments classify that as an emergency and issue these enormous tenders to hire in contract temporary services, and that is the kind of thing where corruption just runs riot.
Many are also asking why the government simply can't establish a list of credible PPE suppliers and buy from them.
We know that Imperial Logistics offered their warehousing and transport facilities to allow government to buy centrally and store it centrally and then distribute from that central location, and yet that offer was never taken up.
The ANC didn't take it up, says Hill Lewis, because it's in the ruling party's interests to keep the COVID honeypot open by creating a complex web of suppliers that makes it easier for its corrupt members to steal. President Cyril Ramaphosa says all allegations like this will be investigated, and if necessary, ANC members will face criminal charges. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The South African government has broken its silence on Zimbabwe's crackdown on dissent, but its response has attracted more anger than its silence did. South Africa's International Relations Department says the government is concerned, but will only assist if needed. As Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg, many people are accusing South Africa of choosing not to see the realities in its troubled neighbor.
Department of International Relations and Cooperation spokesperson Lunga Ngangelele told the media that Minister Naledi Panda is concerned with developments in Zimbabwe.
The day before yesterday, she had a conversation with the Minister of Foreign Affairs in Zimbabwe, wherein she was assuring the Minister of South Africa's willingness to assist.
But the South African government's response has been met with anger from many Zimbabweans who describe it as mute and unconcerned. Zimbabwean National Prudence Moyo says it is disappointing that South Africa seems to be asking the abuser for permission to intervene, while those being abused have long asked for help.
South Africa's intervention in Zimbabwe's situation is long overdue. People are suffering, people are beaten. Do they want to see grace to show that Zimbabweans are being killed day in and day out? People have tried in whatever means they can, through voting, through demonstrations, but then the system favors ZANU.
Others argue that if arbitrary arrests of journalists, activists and opposition figures, disappearance of citizens critical of government, and brutalization of the masses are not compelling enough for South Africa to rein in its neighbor, maybe Pretoria is waiting for blood to flow. Zimbabwean academic Bongani Nyati has welcomed South Africa's stance to raise concern, but says verbal condemnations with no actions are not what Zimbabweans need right now.
Zimbabweans shouldn't expect much. The ANC's actions will be limited to these verbal condemnation and symbolic moves. Otherwise, Zimbabwean protesters and human rights campaigners should actually know that they are on their own. They should not expect much from the ANC and the South African government.
International relations expert Sipamandla Zondi says international law leaves very little room for a country to interfere in the internal affairs of another. He, however, warns that if action is not taken soon, the crisis could spin out of control in a country dealing with a rapidly deteriorating economy and growing hunger, among other debilitating problems.
There would be an open revolution. There would be a descent into violence. It might force the opposition in Zimbabwe to come an armed rebel group of some form, because the patience of the people of Zimbabwe might just be at that level where they might escalate things to levels we've never seen before.
Zondi says it would be wise for South Africa to influence the Southern African Development Community and the African Union to stand in unison and read the Riot Act to Zimbabwe. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Heidi Adams Fitzpatrick in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, do visit our website at voanews.com. Thank you for listening, and thank you for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.